John was not for the money.
1 Corinthians 9, the worker deserves his
right?
wages. I wouldn't say that anymore, John.
Okay.
Very humble and spiritual.
Okay, so we're now going to talk a little bit about the Catholic Reformation. Again, these are attempts within Catholicism to do what the Protestant Reformation ended up doing. And it's kind of fun to imagine, think about what it would have been like if the Catholic Church could have reformed itself just a little bit more. And also if the printing press hadn't come out. But anyway, that's not what happened, so it's just a fun thing to think about. So we have our friend Erasmus. And Erasmus was a insanely prolific writer. The guy was, it was just absolutely nuts. I mean, just, I don't know how many tens and tens and thousands of pages he produced. His greatest love in life was basically being a scholar and studying Greek and studying the Bible. And he was the greatest Greek scholar of his day. He was the greatest Hebrew scholar of his day. He was the greatest Latin scholar of his day. He was the greatest. The guy was just absolutely insane in his prolificness. I'm sure that's not a word. I mentioned in Praise of Folly. That's just this little tiny thing he wrote. He's really famous for it, but, I mean, he just wrote that in a few days sort of as a joke. But basically what it is, it's saying, oh, isn't it so wonderful, all these monks and how they do this and that. You know, it's totally, totally sarcastic in Praise of Folly. But then at the end of the book, he talks about being a fool for Christ. Hmm. And Greg's right top five sermons in all history, fools for Christ. Whose fool are you? And basically, I think he stole his sermon from Erasmus. All right, and so people love this guy because they hated the Catholic Church. All right, at least the silliness of it. They didn't hate God or Christ, but they hated the ridiculous things. And so he blistered the whole idea of indulgences and pilgrimages and saying thousands and thousands of masses. Basically says, let's go back to the Bible. Let's just do things like in the Bible. What's wrong with that? All right. Probably his most influential thing that he produced is known as the Textus Receptus, which was the accepted Greek text. And the Greek text of Erasmus, and he put fantastic, huge scholarship into this. You have to understand, he had something like, I don't know, 8 manuscripts instead of, how many do we have, like 5,000 Greek manuscripts? He only had a few. His oldest Greek manuscripts were from somewhere around 1100 AD. All right, so the quality of the manuscripts he has weren't very many. And they were, almost all of the Byzantine text. And so, like those verses in the Bible that aren't supposed to be there, like in 1 John 5, whatever, and all those things. Those are all in his Greek text. Anyway, he produced a brilliantly scholarly Greek text, which was the basis for Luther's translation. It was the basis for every single translation, not just Protestant translation, but eventually when the Roman Catholic Church finally got its act together, when the Roman Catholic Church started to produce translations, they finally decided to not use the Vulgate. They were really slow about that. All right. He was the most famous man in Europe until 1517. All that changed. He spent a lot of time in England. He was friends with Thomas More. All those great medieval scholars in England. He was a monk in Holland. But eventually, when the Reformation started, he had to go to Basel. Because although he completely disagree with Augustine on predestination, and he hated Augustine on his anti-intellectualism. But as far as his reforms of heteropraxy, he was with him heart and soul. All right, and so the poor guy, he was standing between two worlds that were moving apart. If you stand, you know, you imagine on two trucks, one truck, another truck, and they both start moving, you're going to have some problems going on there. The bottom line is, it's like Camus, you know, this book about this guy on the hill. He's trying to avoid deciding between the two, and the problem comes right to his house. So bottom line is, Luther had no choice. He had to take a stand. In fact, a famous quote from one of his Catholic people is, he said, let me see. So long as he refuses to write against Luther, we take him to be Lutheran. And the Lutheran said, as long as he refuses to write against the Pope, we assume he's a papist. So he was caught between two worlds. And he tried desperately. He was not a guy to take a stand on those kind of things. He just wanted to do scholarship. A very spiritual guy, but the bottom line is he was not, I guess courage wasn't his greatest strength, although he wrote many things that could have gotten him killed, honestly, a lot of things. Yeah.
The Textus Receptus, was that what was used when they were putting together the King James?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All the not just the English translations, all the translations.
And if we're going to get there later, then just tell me to stop. But the King James Bible, are we going to talk about why the Catholic Church just adopted that one when it wasn't really for them?
The Catholic Church did not adopt it.
Well, today's Catholic Church definitely does.
Well, not initially. Okay. They had their own translation.
Okay.
No, because that was a Protestant translation. Okay. All right. Actually, there's going to be a slide, and the slide's going to be things I'm not going to take the time to cover, even though they're in my book. And I've got a little section on the English translations. Tyndale's was the first translation. He completed the New Testament. He didn't quite complete the Old Testament. Then there's the Coverdale Bible. So basically what you had is the Geneva Bible, which was the Calvinist Bible. And then you had the Tyndale and the Coverdale, which was essentially a Lutheran Bible. And then you had the King James, which was an Anglican Bible. And then the Catholics had their Bible, the Douay, I think it was. But all of them go back to Tyndale's work. Tyndale was the seminal guy on creating an English Bible. Of course, he got executed for doing it.
So Tyndale was using this, the Textus Receptus?
Absolutely. Of course, you got the Hebrew text as well, and they're just using the Masoretic.
Right.
There was not a lot of, that's what the Jews were using for their Bible.
Right.
People were not using Greek Bibles. They were using Latin Bibles. Okay? Yeah, good. So anyway, he moved to Basel, tried to find middle ground. He completely and utterly failed. Ultimately, he declared Catholic, and he died Catholic. And honestly, I think if he had to choose, considering who he was, he probably made the right choice. Because there's no way he's going to follow Luther on Calvinism, or not Calvinism, on Augustinianism. He was Thomas Aquinas guy. He was definitely not an Augustinian. So in the end, he had to choose. He wrote a book, A Disquisition of the Free Will. Is that on the Freedom of the Will. And this was written directly to oppose Luther. And by 1517 is when the Reformation began. He kind of hemmed and hawed. If he could have done anything to get Erasmus to come out in his favor. In fact, if Erasmus had come out in his favor, who knows? All of Europe might have gone for the Reformation. Probably not. But France, I'd say, almost certainly would have. Poland would have. Maybe Spain and Italy would not have. All right, so he held the linchpin in this time. But by about 1523, he just flat out said, no, he denied Luther, and he declared for Catholicism. Some people would think that was a very cowardly thing to do. I don't know about that. All right, another important figure in the Catholic Reformation is the Jesuits. All right, and the Jesuits, they're amazing. These guys are amazing. Ignatius Loyola, he'd been a soldier. He had a spiritual awakening. He moved to Paris for education. He wasn't a priest at the time. And at Paris, he formed these small groups and it's spiritual exercise. He was a mystic. There are a number of mystics I mentioned in my book, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila. Mysticism is a significant aspect of Christianity. To at least, I think, dabble in, not to become a mystic, but to allow your thinking about God and Christ and relationship with God, allow it to at least, allow mysticism to at least flavor your understanding about God. He was a mystic. He formed these groups where they would go through these spiritual exercises. And the purpose of the spiritual exercise was so you'd have a mystical experience of God. And, other mystics didn't have these really, really practical means. He had a very, very, very practical means. And the spiritual exercises, my wife, when she went to Gonzaga University, she studied the spiritual exercises. Of course, that's a Jesuit university. All right. So anyway, he formed the Society of Jesus. Now, can you imagine how all these other monks felt about these guys are the Jesus monks? I mean,
yeah.
Wow, a little prideful, a little arrogant there.
Like Church of Christ.
Yeah, like Church of Christ. Yeah, kind of like that. But the thing is, up until this time, all monks were subject to the local bishop. And so the bishops held a fair amount of power separate from the papacy in Rome, even at this time. But the Jesuits are the first ones who they answered only to the Pope. So you can imagine the Pope was happy to, support their order. But later on, in the 1700s, the Jesuits were banned everywhere in the world. Because that's when the nation states were totally eminent in power and the papacy was worth squat. So eventually, their being tied to the papacy got them completely suppressed everywhere in the world. And even the papacy had to eventually renounce them because for political reasons. So they're answerable only to the Pope. These guys were fantastically zealous missionaries. They weren't the first Catholic missionaries. In fact, they weren't even formed until the 1540s, around 1540 or so. By then, there were Dominican friars and Franciscan friars and Augustinian and Cistercian. I mean, so the very first Catholic missionaries were clearly not Jesuits. But within a generation, maybe a third or half of all missionaries were Jesuit priests. They really stressed education. And the reason is they were outside of the system. They didn't have these bishop schools. So they had to develop their own educational system. And I would say, I taught at a Jesuit university, and I loved their educational philosophy. It's beautiful. Now, these guys are liberal as all get out. I mean, the whole idea of the Jesuits was to be in the world instead of separate. This was a brand new idea. An order that would never, ever live in a monastery. Right? They would go to universities, and they'd be trained for 10, 15 years of full-time school before they'd even be ordained. These guys were educated to death. All right? And so within a couple of generations, many, many Jesuit universities were popping up all over the world, including in Asia, in South America, in Central America. So the Spanish Empire, the Portuguese Empire. Yeah.
When you say they're liberal, what do you mean? Like, what made them?
Well, how about this? Worldly?
Okay.
We went to a Jesuit university, and my wife went in to see her advisor. This priest is like, how can I help you? And these guys are getting drunk and this kind of stuff. And the Jesuits are worldly, both in the good sense and in the bad sense. They're worldly as in they were in the world trying to affect the world. In fact, their initial worldliness, I would say, was a beautiful thing. It was an awesome thing. Okay, but, you know, if you spend too much time in the world, get affected by the world. So they're, I would say, a theologically liberal, a philosophically liberal order.
Would this look like kind of like how when the Pharisees looked at Jesus kind of at the parties, fellowship, was similar to that kind of point of view where the other monks were abstaining, they were doing the asceticism, they were doing all that. These guys were kind of more at the events, they were with the people, they were celebrating, they were doing this.
I think that's a valid description. Yes, they didn't stress asceticism as much as the other groups, although they did have asceticism, believe me. You know, the flagellants and all that. There's Jesuits doing that kind of stuff. Okay. There were. Now, along with the Dominicans, the Jesuits and the Dominicans were the chief arm of the papacy. And they were the ones putting the Inquisition into effect. Even more so the Dominicans than the Jesuits. So their job was to defeat Protestantism primarily by preaching. Right, and by persuading people, whereas the Dominicans were trying to convert people back to Catholicism by killing them, essentially. All right, so I would say they were the happy version of the Counter-Reformation. But they were the chief force in the Counter-Reformation was the Jesuits. Yeah.
Did people ever baptize dead people?
I mean, literally dead people?
Yeah, literally dead people.
Maybe by accident. Why?
You just said before.
Unconscious people. Well, I mean, the Mormons do baptisms for dead people. No, I don't think anybody baptized a dead person, except maybe by accident. By the way, there's Ignatius Loyola, but I need to mention Francis Xavier. Francis Xavier, I would say, may very well be the greatest evangelist in all history. And who am I saying he's greater than that? You know,
Paul.
Well, Jesus was not a great evangelist.
That's true.
I mean, Francis Xavier, this guy.
Wait, you got to back that up. Why is that?
Well, I mean, just look at his career. So Ignatius Loyola had an inner group of about six guys. These were his guys. And they all went on missions. But Xavier, this guy was, it's crazy. So he went to Lisbon, and from there he went to India, he went to Malacca, he went to Sri Lanka, Ceylon, to the East Indies, to China, Japan. And he planted Catholicism in Japan, the very first Catholicism in Japan, and the Philippines. This guy planted churches everywhere. I don't think I included a slide here, but if, in the book you can see some of the places he went to. So, you know, it's debatable. In my notes, it says, the greatest mission in all history, perhaps even more than Paul, but maybe not. You know, it depends on how you define great. But in terms of the travels he did, the risks he took, the far-flung places where he planted churches, it absolutely amazing. Well, okay. Okay. You know. Again, it depends on how you define great, right? And he started the church in Japan, and the Catholic Church was fantastically successful in Japan. There were hundreds of thousands of Christians there. And by the way, Hiroshima was a majority Christian city in the 16th century. Hiroshima was a majority Christian city. Yeah. What happened was the shogun decided this ain't going to happen. What was that movie? It came out about 5 or 6 years ago about the horrendous persecutions of the Catholics.
Silence.
I mean, crazy stuff. And hundreds of priests lost their lives. I mean, the courage of these monks, not just the Jesuits, but the Jesuits, these guys were crazy committed. It's unbelievable.
What time was that?
Let me see, they entered Japan in like the late 1540s, And I think towards the end of the 16th century, like 1590, something like that. Yeah.
Persecution started happening?
Yeah. But by then, there were hundreds of thousands of Catholics, you know, Christian. I'm going to call them Christians, all right? His missionary work in China was very successful. His missionary work in what we'd call Indonesia, wildly successful in Western India and in Ceylon. Okay, great. So now we're going to start the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. All right. You have to realize the world was Christianized by Catholic missionaries, all right? Let's just be straight about it. There was virtually no significant Protestant missionary work all the way into the mid-1700s. This is more than 200 years after the Reformation began. All right? And so you've got Lutheranism, Calvinism, the Anglican Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Dutch Reformed Church. And when the Dutch created their empire, they didn't evangelize. When the British created their empire, they didn't evangelize. The French did, but they were Catholic. And the Spanish and the Portuguese did. They did incredible work. Now, was there some bad stuff going on? Yeah. Are you kidding? Prince Charles, Prince Philip, King Charles, King Philip, these were very, very sincerely religious men who saw the creation of the Spanish Empire as a work of God. Now, you could be cynical about that and feel free, but I'm telling you, just think about how much Christianity spread because of the Spanish and the Portuguese empires. It's truly amazing. All right, well, these Protestants were just fighting amongst each other and arguing about minor points, really. All right, so let's give credit where credit's due. And you say, yeah, but they're Catholic. Oh, okay, I guess so. You're right, but so? Oh, okay. How'd that happen? I've got Martin Luther, whatever. It just ended up in the wrong order. That's fine. So let's talk about Martin Luther. All right. Catholic priest and Augustinian monk. The fact that he was Augustinian is very significant. Because like I said, Luther created Augustinian Christianity. Think about Augustine. Let's list about 10 things about Augustine.
Original sin.
Good.
Double predestination.
Yeah.
Total
depravity.
Yeah.
You got rid of that.
I got rid of that.
Whew. So we're all right. So we got three things he kept. One thing he got rid of. What about church state? Yes or no?
Yes.
Christendom. See, I'm going to talk about two Protestant reformations. This is just my take on it. Surely somebody's written a thesis on this idea. I haven't found one, but then I didn't scan the literature. But in my opinion, there were two reformations. There was the magisterial reformation, and then there was the non-magisterial reformation. All right, anyway, let me see. Asceticism. Got rid of that. All right. Basically, what he did was he kept the theology of Augustine and he rejected the false practice of Augustine. Kept the theology, rejected the practice. Okay? And we will give great honor where honor's due. Luther, Zwingli, which really Huss and Wycliffe would have done if they could have. Because if Wycliffe and Huss's reformations had been successful, you can imagine what would you have to extrapolate to imagine where they would have ended up. But anyway, it is significant that Luther was an Augustinian monk for two reasons. Number one, that means when he joined the monastery, he had very, very extreme ascetic practices in his situation, which created a big problem for him. Big problem. But also, you have to understand that his theology was Augustinian beginning, middle, and end, with almost no exception. His anti-intellectualism was Augustinian. All right, he apparently suffered from severe bouts of depression. In understanding Luther without understanding his bouts of depression and his depressive episodes, probably you're not fully getting Luther if you don't get that. He was a very, very guilt-ridden, guilt-prone person. Just think about a person you know who's like always feeling guilt. Oh my goodness, get over it. All right, think about a friend that's like that, or maybe it's yourself. I don't know. All right, that's Augustine. Very, very much controlled by guilt. And so you put him in the Catholic system, and somebody who's prone to guilt, put him in a Catholic system. Oh, my goodness gracious. All right? And so that's what happened. Here's a quote from Luther about himself. He says, "I was a good monk, and I kept the rule of my order so strictly that I may say that if ever a monk got to heaven by his monkery, it was I. All my brothers in the monastery who knew me will hear me out. If I had kept on any longer, I should have killed myself with vigils, prayers, reading, and other work." And he is not exaggerating. I mean, because he had this tremendous sense of guilt, and he was convinced that if he just, you know, denied himself more and more and more, he'd finally relieve that guilt. Yeah. And then he started studying the book of Romans. All right? And so, yeah, the emotional relief of finding out that salvation is by faith alone and not by works for a person like Luther, who, by the way, struggled with guilt throughout the rest of his life anyway. All right.
Yeah, I read that he died of a burst heart and that'd be high blood pressure. So I think that depression was mixed with anxiety.
Yeah.
And stress. So
he did live to be 60.
High anxiety person.
Yeah.
And I have high blood pressure. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. Maybe not a completely different personality type. You're a driven person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Martin Luther was definitely driven, that's for sure. All right, so you can relate to him a little bit then. Good. Yeah. All right, so anyway, he had this religious experience, a thunderstorm kind of thing. Right. So here we go. So in 1510, he traveled to Rome. He was a monk at this point, an Augustinian monk, and he traveled to Rome. It's like, I'm going to Rome, the center of, it's like a Church of Christ, they're going to Abilene, you know, or maybe, you know, a Christian going to Jerusalem. It's like, I'm going to this spiritual mecca of great spiritual people. And he goes to Rome, and he was disgusted with the worldliness and the wealth and the popes and the cardinals and their fancy stuff and the art. That's what our indulgence money has been paying for? This is the time when St. Peter's was being built. All right, this is, you know, the Machiavellian Rome was going on. And he was disgusted and I would say very disillusioned. So he went back to his monastery. He tried even more ascetic, to even be more ascetic. Now, luckily, his monk, you know, the head of the monk, what do they call it?
Abbot
or whatever. He realized that he was going to kill himself. So what he did was he sent him to Wittenberg to become a professor and probably saved his life and maybe saved Christianity to boot. All right, I don't know. So his mentor was Staupitz. I'm not going to ask you that name in a test. Staupitz was a great, he was, you know, He was a devout Catholic curate or whatever you'd call it, whatever. So he sent him to Wittenberg to basically teach Greek and to teach Bible. At Wittenberg, he started by studying the Psalms, but then he switched over. In 1515, he began to study Romans, and he discovered Romans 1:17, and it completely changed his life, and I would say changed the entire course of history, mm-hmm. actually.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. Not 1517, by the way, 1515. And he discovered that the righteous will live by faith. Or those who through faith are righteous shall live. So I'm going to live by what? By faith. Not by indulgences, not by purgings, and not by whipping myself, and not by denying myself every possible pleasure. And it was a revelation. Absolutely, absolutely. He's not there yet. I mean, that's not till 1524, but he headed down that road. Sure, no doubt about it. So, he began to teach salvation by faith alone. So we have faith alone, grace alone, scripture alone, right? All right, do you believe in grace alone? I believe in grace alone. I mean, there's no other. It's nothing of me. It's absolutely nothing of me that gets me saved. I don't know. I'm sure we could have a debate about that. We maybe have to define it, but I'm going to go for grace alone.
Yeah.
How about sola scriptura? The only source of truth is the Bible. The only authoritative. Yep, we're with them on that. What about faith alone? Are we saved by faith alone?
No.
Well, it depends on how you define faith. It depends on what you mean by that. All right? Now, when he translated the Greek New Testament into German in Romans 3:28, he put faith alone. Let's go there. That's interesting. By the way, do Bible translators ever put a word into the English that's not found in the Greek?
If you do it
all the time. Well, that's different. And what I'm saying is there's only one Greek word and they give you two English words. You see what I'm saying? So baptizo is that's a transliteration.
Right.
So I mean, there's a Greek word and sometimes it'll have three English words.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So it's the fact that he added the word alone. You know, there was no Greek word for alone, that doesn't prove it's wrong. But I don't know. We have to read the scripture here, right? So what's it? Romans 3:28, right? Romans 3:28. And by the way, faith alone—that is the central tenet of Protestantism. If somebody asks you if you're Protestant, the answer is absolutely not. You are not a Protestant by virtually any possible definition. So Romans, what did I say? 3:28? Yeah. I'm getting there. You're probably already there. Okay, great. For we maintain that a person is justified by faith alone, apart from works. All right? But, you know, it's interesting because in Ephesians 1, it says we're saved by grace, not by works. And yet in James 2, it says faith apart from works doesn't save you. Those seem to contradict. Here's one thing. Here's kind of a principle I've learned. When you have two statements that appear to contradict in the Bible like that, you have an opportunity for an awesome sort of discovery. And here's how I think about it. I say, ask yourself which is the more fundamental truth. Because in Exodus it says, God punishes those to the fourth generation who sin against him. And in Ezekiel 18 it says, the soul that sins is the one who will die. I will not hold the son accountable for the sin of the father, or the father for the sin of the son. Which is the more fundamental truth? Ezekiel is the more fundamental truth. And then you have to ask, well, then what's Exodus talking about? It's talking about in this life, the physical consequences of sin. So which is the more fundamental truth? We're saved by grace, not by works, or we are not saved by faith apart from works. Which is the more fundamental truth about Christianity?
Saved by grace.
Saved by grace, not by works. You go there first, and then you go to James. But what Luther did is he went there first, and he said, James can't be right. I believe he was overreacting to this horrendous thing. His experience as an Augustinian monk, he virtually killed himself. So it was an overreaction, but I'm telling you, this is the key tenet of Protestantism. This is it. All right? Yeah, they'll say all three, and it is. It is. I mean, okay, Bible alone. Okay, got it. But I'm telling you, this is what separates a Protestant from a non-Protestant. Not these other things. Not Scripture only, not grace only. Okay? And so that's the great discovery of Luther. Here's another quote. Night and day I pondered the book of Romans until I saw a connection between the justice of God and the statement that the just shall live by faith. Then I grasped that the justice of God is that righteousness by which through grace, that righteousness by which through grace and sheer mercy God justifies us through faith. Thereupon I felt myself to be reborn, to have gone through open doors into paradise. The whole of Scripture took on a new meaning. And whereas before the justice of God had filled me with hate, now it became to me inexpressibly sweet and great love. The passage of Paul became to me a gate of heaven. Okay, great. Now, they asked Jesus, what are the works we must do in order to be saved? And Jesus says, we're saved by grace apart from works, right?
Nope.
No, what did he say?
Faith.
You know, they tell us that baptism is a work. It's a work of salvation. Now, a work is something you do, right? Is baptism something you do? No, it is not.
God does.
It's something done to you physically and spiritually. Mm-hmm. It's physically done to you, and it's spiritually done to you. And I was at the Jordan River a couple of years ago, and then I was at the Sea of Galilee a few months ago. And it's funny because when the Jews do baptisms, they baptize themselves. Did you know that? They self-baptize. Where did being baptized by somebody else come from? From the apostles. It came from God. So why did they switch baptizing yourself to being baptized? Because baptism is not a work. Are works involved in our salvation? Yeah, Jesus said it. That's the irony here. The one thing that he said that saves us is it's a work. So anyway.
So I guess this might be getting into the minutiae of it, but let's say I go to the river and I just drop myself back. Is that myself? Am I baptizing myself?
Whatever, dude. Because nobody's ever going to actually do that. If I was on an island, you know, put it this way: if you're on an island and you had a Bible and you had a river, I would go ahead and baptize myself. That's what I would do. But other than those circumstances, if you want to be rebellious against God, because clearly it's repent and be baptized. Okay, got it? Be baptized. Maybe you could build a machine, and maybe you're on an island, you could build a machine that would baptize you, so you're not baptizing yourself. Or you could say, well, it was gravity baptizing me. Or, I don't know, whatever. All right. All right, so now some people say, well, you know, he didn't really teach faith alone. Oh, yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did. This faith alone, when based upon the sure promises of God, must save us. As our text clearly explains, he's doing a commentary on Romans 3:28. And in light of it all, they must become fools who have taught us other ways to become godly. Man may forever do as he will. He can never enter heaven unless God takes the first step with his word, which offers him divine grace and enlightens his heart so as to get upon the right way. Should one imagine he is able to do anything good of his own strength, he does no less than make Christ the Lord a liar. Do you now see how faith justifies without works? Sin lingers in us, as God hates sin. A transfusion of righteousness, therefore, becomes vitally necessary. This transfusion of righteousness we obtain from Christ because we believe in him. All right, great. He was not trying to abolish Catholicism. He was out to reform it. But you know what? 1570 came along. He published those 95 Theses. And again, he was not trying to do what happened. He was just trying to start a discussion. You know, it's like he's just trying to start a discussion. But because of the printing press, within weeks, thousands and thousands of copies all over Germany, and suddenly he was the hero of everybody. He was an obscure monk teaching in a not particularly important university. But because of the printing press, when he published those 95 theses, which were all about indulgences, what happened is this guy Tetzin came, and he asked for permission. He came from the Pope. He asked for permission to enter a territory to sell indulgences. And this guy was the worst sort. He said, you know, when the coin rings in the box, then you instantly, I can't remember the exact quote. It's in my book. It's really horrible.
It's famous, yeah.
And very, very famous.
And it enraged him.
Oh, it did. He hated that. All right. He said, those who believe they can be certain of their salvation because they have indulgence letters will be eternally damned together with their teachers. All right, that's pretty tough stuff. But believe it or not, he felt like that was a legitimate, acceptable statement within Catholicism. I mean, and I believe he's sincere about that. All right, within days, this all throughout Germany, he's this huge sensation. He began to teach that the Bible is the only authority for truth, sola scriptura. He wrote a book on the Babylonian captivity of the church. That's not good. All right, basically that the church was captive to Satan. That's probably going to get him in a little bit of trouble. He wrote The Freedom of the Christian Man. Now, by the way, this is the one that Erasmus wrote against. Basically, he said the freedom of the Christian man is we have no freedom. Basically said, before we are saved, we have no free will at all. He says we have freedom. We get to choose which mortal sins we commit. But we have basically said we have no will. We are totally, utterly depraved. Of course, this is just Augustine. All right. So anyway, they brought him before the Diet at Worms. I can't remember. Let me see. Here he is. So he'd had another disputation. And there's,
it's Johann Tetzel.
Tetzel, yeah.
As soon as a coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs.
Yes, there you go.
47.
There you go. Something like that. Of course, it was probably in Latin, so that, you know, it's a close version of it. Okay, great. By the way, you know, I think Luther is amazing.
Yeah.
I think he's awesome. He's got some bad points. You know, when I tell people, I think Augustine's pretty amazing, they kind of give me a look like, how could you say that? Because everything he said was wrong. I still think he's an amazing man. I really do. And I believe Augustine was sincere. Anyway, so the bottom line is he was called to account not for the 95 Theses, but instead for the writing on the Babylonian captivity of the church.
Can you explain that a little more? He was saying that the Catholic Church is being under control of Satan, but what did he say specifically to bring up the Babylonian thing?
Basically saying the church is, you know, the papacy is not of God. See, he 1517, he was not trying to denounce his Catholicism. 1520, all right? It's only 3 years later. He's basically very close. Remember, Wycliffe called the Pope the Antichrist, right? And he is almost, by 1520, he's almost where Wycliffe ended up, okay? And so, at that point, what's going to happen is it's clear. I mean, he's going to be declared a heretic. It's obvious. All right? Anyway, let's see here. Okay, good. So he said, unless I'm convinced by Scripture and plain reason, I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the Word of God. I cannot and I will not recant anything. For to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. Here I stand. His most famous biography. Here I stand. That was brave. I'm telling you, he assumed he would not get out of that meeting alive. He was given safe passage, but John Huss was given safe passage to the Council of Constance. And you know what happened to him? Burned at the stake. All right, so trusting the Roman magistrates and their safe conduct promises, that's a fool's errand to say the least. So he got up and he defended his teachings. He refused to renounce any of the things he published, including the Babylonian captivity of the church. And amazingly, he escaped alive. The reason is he had the support of Frederick the Wise. Now, Frederick was... Yeah, the German guy, he was the local prince, but eventually became Holy Roman Emperor. All right, and so the bottom line is he had political power in this area. All right, at this time he was not Holy Roman Emperor, so the Holy Roman Emperor tried to kill Luther, but his friend Frederick the Wise hit him. He sent him to Wurttemberg, which is a castle, somewhere in, it's not near Wittenberg. And basically hid for like a couple of years or something like that, a significant length of time. During his time at Wartburg is where he published his greatest number of writings by far. So he's hiding out in a castle, letting his hair grow, not doing the tonsure anymore, wearing the clothes of a soldier, letting his beard grow. But during that time, he produced his Bible, Luther's Bible, which I would say probably is the most influential Bible in history other than the Vulgate. I mean, King James, Tyndale, I'd say probably Luther's Bible and the Vulgate are the two most important Bibles in history. All right, let's talk about predestination, all right? Free will after the fall exists in name only. Got that? This is translated. It's a quote, translated quote from Luther. Free will after the fall exists in name only. In other words, we have no free will. In other words, you do not choose whether you will be saved or not. You do not choose to respond. God chooses for you to respond. So what does that mean about all the other people? Right, he chooses them to go to hell, right? So it is God's choice that almost everybody goes to hell. That's Luther's doctrine. But that's Augustine, so what else? All right. So free will after the fall exists in name only, and as long as it does what it is able, it commits mortal sin. In other words, the only freedom you have outside of Christ is you get to choose which mortal sins you commit and how many. But you cannot do a single good thing. No good work. All works done outside of Christ are evil works, no matter how good they might seem to be. All right? Okay, let me see. Where are my quotes? I've got a bunch of quotes on predestination. I must have skipped them. It's all right. It doesn't matter. There's some good ones there. All right. So anyway, the Pope issued a bull against him. He's hiding out in Wurttemberg. In the meantime, Karlstadt and others are back in Wittenberg doing all kinds of wacky stuff. He wanted to have a gradual reformation because he knew if he let things go too fast, it would get out of control. He was very politically astute, a very, very politically astute reformer, but it's all in my book. I don't have time to go over that. Anyway, in the first edition of his Bible, he literally made James an appendix. He wanted to take it all together. He called it a book of straw, or he said it has nothing of the nature of the gospel about it. He also called Revelation dumb prophecy. He wanted Revelation removed from the Bible completely. By the way, just, you know, it's slightly overstated. The bottom line is, in later editions, he removed that comment about being a book of straw, and he stopped trying to remove James or Revelation, and he kind of accepted what his friend said. Luther, you can't do that. Martin, you can't do that. And so, it is true he said that, and the reason he said it is for the reasons that you think. But actually, he said that only in the first edition, and later on those statements kind of disappeared, for what it's worth. Okay, so he began to reject almost all of these heteroprax things, but not all. He was more Catholic by far, say, than Zwingli or Calvin. So he still had stained glass windows. The priest still wore robes. He still had sort of an investiture of priests. But he did get rid of celibacy. All the convents were emptied out. Question?
Well, I was going to say, did he marry?
He did eventually, yes. Okay. He was not the first to marry. Many others married before him. He was very hesitant to marry. He saw it as being a hindrance to his ministry.
Isn't that a funny story behind that? Didn't he end up with some leftover woman?
Yeah, so there were something like 12 women brought to his house in barrels to escape a convent. And there was one who was the least marryable of the 12. So he said, all right, I'll take her. Yeah, that's true. All right. But actually, he had many children. And, I'm reading 500 years later, so it's hard to know. But apparently, he was a more than satisfactory husband and a more than satisfactory father. He doted on his children. He loved his children. He spent lots of time with his children and his wife. He was very, very loyal to his wife. His children were upstanding people. Seemed like a good father. And his family was used as the model within Lutheranism, even up to modern times. So give the guy credit there. He seemed to do an excellent job. All right. Wrote the Freedom of the Christian Man, blah, 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 people, bull. In 1524, here's a quote. This was written down. He said, 1524, I will never take a wife. Famous last words.
Oh, yeah, right.
1525, he married. All right. Model home life. Let's talk about him and Zwingli. Let's talk about Luther and Zwingli. Okay. If there's any two people you think could get together, it would have been Luther and Zwingli. They agreed on almost everything. In fact, they eventually published when they had this meeting at Marburg. They had this really, really famous meeting at Marburg. And it was as much to have a political as a religious alliance because the Catholic powers were beginning to attack. All right, this is around 1530. And there's only one doctrine they could not agree on, and that was on the Lord's Supper. And Luther believed in consubstantiation. So he believed in what we would call the doctrine of the real presence. So he believed that Jesus is truly present in the bread and the wine, not in some gross sort of ridiculous, I would say if you read church fathers in the second and third century, they seem to have been all consubstantiationalism people. Okay, so it seems to be that the doctrine of the early church, I can't say the first century, but the doctrine of the second and third century was consubstantiation, as opposed to Zwingli's doctrine, which is that it is merely a remembrance. Yeah.
What's the difference between that and the one you said before?
Transubstantiation is the idea that it's physically transformed.
It becomes the body.
It becomes physically body and blood, which seems ridiculous because if you throw up later on, you're not going to see any chunks of flesh. But that's what they taught.
Yeah. Okay, so this is not as radical as that.
No, in fact, You might want to consider the possibility that consubstantiation might even be the correct teaching. You might want to allow yourself to consider that. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just saying there certainly is language in the New Testament that can support the idea of consubstantiation. He did say, eat this is my body. All right. Now, what Zwingli said is that means this is like my body. Luther said, no. If he said, this is my body, he means, this is my body. Zwingli says, if he says, this is my body, there's lots of things where they're metaphors. Yeah.
So Catholics are saying we're consuming the flesh and the blood. Luther's saying we're consuming the spirit of Christ.
No, he's saying that Christ is present.
So he's like watching me. He's there. He's brought into that moment.
Let's do this. Let's go all the way to...
It's sort of this dualism of spiritual versus physical.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
Go ahead. Yeah.
This is Calvin. Because to me, I say it's a mystery. Mm-hmm. And isn't it just better to let it be a mystery? It's kind of like, the nature of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Three persons, one right. Substance. Is that accurate? Probably not. It's probably not. It's at best a metaphor, and it could even be a somewhat inaccurate metaphor. So, why do we have to settle these questions? But Calvin's, I love it. He's so smart. He asked the rhetorical question, in what way, so far as it affected upon us, is concerned, is the body of Christ in the sacrament? I love his answer. Genuinely and effectively. So is he a consubstantiationist? I don't know. He basically says, let's just let the words speak for themselves and leave it at that. That's what Calvin did. Brilliant. Very, very smart. And he basically got around the problem by saying, look, it's a mystery. I don't know. It says it, so I believe it. But if I can't decide, let's not define it. So I'm telling you, Luther and Zwingli were very, very stubborn. Which, if they hadn't been, they never would have had their movements. Their reforms would have never happened. Very, very stubborn. So, but it led to, it basically, it meant that the two movements separated, and they anathematized each other. They said, Zwingli said, all Lutherans are going to hell, and Luther said, all Zwingliites are going to hell. It's terrible. Over this one thing.
Right.
How ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay, I need to finish up Luther. How long have I been going this time?
About an hour.
Ooh, okay, I better stop. Good. We'll do one more session before lunch. I don't know what time it is, but...
Almost 11.
All right, good. So, the later part of Luther's life, the last 10 years of his life were almost as much sad as happy, although he still had a happy family life. He was sick, and the evidence is that he became more and more of a curmudgeon, kind of angry. He always had an anger problem. But his anger problem seems to have taken a more dominant place in his life. So a few things happened later on in his life. First of all, there's the peasants' revolt. Now, Luther was, a very, very smart guy. And he realized that basically what he was giving is the Bible back to individuals. So everybody has freedom of conscience. Wow. Imagine these people who've had no freedom of conscience forever. If you give freedom of conscience to everybody suddenly, it's kind of like what happened to our church in 2003. Nobody's told what to do anymore. So people just, man, I'm telling you, people went crazy. Well, it's kind of like that. And so he realized the possibility was for complete, utter, not just religious anarchy, but even political anarchy. And he feared that. He deeply feared it, as he should have. And as a church leader, if you're going to bring a reformation to your church, watch the pace. Watch the pace of reform. All right? Here's where you know you need to take it. Here's who we are. Be wise on how you do that. All right? And I would say, on balance, Luther was pretty wise about it, honestly. But in certain parts of Germany, this peasants' revolt, and it was a social and political revolt. It was not a religious revolt. But I'm telling you, if it were not for Luther's religious reform, this peasants' revolt probably wouldn't have happened. They'd had other peasant revolts, but this was the largest peasant revolt in the entire history of Germany. Okay? Anyway, 1525. Luther supported massacres of tens of thousands, and he wrote it public in writing. He published a scathing letter titled Against the Robbing and Murdering Hordes of Peasants. Can you imagine Jesus writing a letter against the robbing and murdering hordes of peasants? Can you imagine? Whew, man, I'm telling you. He advised the landowners to, in quotes, smite, slay, stab, secretly, openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It says, kill them all. And even use lying and deceit to trick them so you can kill them. That was his advice. That's kind of a stain on Luther's character. Yeah, a little bit. Now, on the other hand, with the Anabaptist movement, which we're going to learn about later, with the Anabaptist movement, he was supportive of the Anabaptist freedom. He believed in freedom of conscience. And I believe he sincerely believed in freedom of conscience, but the problem is his was a magisterial reformation. There's a dichotomy right there. So he strongly encouraged people not to round up and murder the Anabaptists. But the problem was, as we'll see, Anabaptists ultimately were seen as traitors because your citizenship was based on your baptism. So if you don't get baptized until you're an adult, who are you a citizen of? Whose property are you anymore? So ultimately, for political reasons, Luther was forced to accept the position that Zwingli gladly accepted, and the church gladly accepted. So the Zwinglis killed them, the Roman Catholics killed them, and ultimately the Lutherans did as well. So he supported and countenanced the rounding up and murder of hundreds and even thousands of Anabaptists. All right? Because Anabaptism was sedition and treason, as we'll see. Another stain is he wrote scathing anti-Semitic polemics. These things were all later in his life, you know, after 1530, these things were happening. Well, the Peasants' Revolt was in the 1520s, but so ultimately he wrote some stuff against Jews that, to modern eyes, are just completely unacceptable. Okay, just a very slight on the aftermath. He was succeeded by Philip Melanchthon, who was a greater scholar than Luther, was probably a better theologian than Luther. All right. Now, he wasn't a man of action like Luther. He wasn't this great reformer. But also, Philip Melanchthon was more like a Erasmian scholar. Luther was anti-intellectual. Philip Melanchthon was a humanist and an intellectual. He was the counterbalance to Luther, right, which was a great idea. They kind of balanced each other out the whole time. Melanchthon was like 20. He was a Greek professor there in Wittenberg when Luther was more like 40 or something like that. So he lived for at least 20 years, maybe 30 years after Luther. And Lutheranism today is really Melanchthonism, right? Lutheranism today was created not by Martin Luther, but by Philip Melanchthon. And for example, Lutheranism is not double predestination. Lutheranism is not Calvinist. All right? They're not Calvinist because of Melanchthon. His predestination was much softer. Okay? All right, Zwingli, after the break. Philip Melanchthon. I'm getting hungry. Man, we better do our third session short.
Yeah, I just looked up some of Martin's things on the Jews. You're right. It's pretty bad.
It's not good.
Burn their synagogue. Burn their home.